in Scripture. I think we'll try to see what that is. I don't know all the answers, but I think it's something we need to wrestle with and understand. To what extent has the differences that God has placed in men make them different and drive them to do things that are unique in a particular way? How can that be abused, overused in some way or not? That's a little bit of the tension we'll look at tonight and tomorrow. But the problem is I had to take that material and take a bunch of stuff out. So we'll not, I've taken things out, believe it or not, and then I will probably skip some things as we go through. Here are the lessons. I want to start with the big picture. How did this men-women thing happen? And I think that's important as a background. It's a little theoretical. And then work through the character that results from that story, the story of the creation and the fall. Character of husbands, particularly fathers, and so on, more specific things and actions as we go. I have goals when I'm trying to teach, if I'm careful and have the time to think it through. These are the things I'd like to accomplish, but I can't measure them. They're in some way abstract goals. I hope we're different when we're done, that we have a better understanding of God's plan for spiritual leadership contrasted to the world's. And opposed to the world is not probably the best English, but I really do mean we have to oppose the world in some ways too, not just contrast with the world. Make a clear, honest assessment of ourselves compared to God's ideal spiritual leader. So if we can figure out what that is, how are we falling short of that? And what can we do to change? Improve daily performance. I hope you'll have a questionnaire or two that will trigger some action on your part. Maybe a resolve to do something a little different in our daily activities. And then set goals and make plans to prepare ourselves to be better in the future that will fix those things where we fall short. Now, I also try to have objectives. And these are things that I ought to be able to measure when this course is over. Now, whether they change your life or not, I can't really tell. But I can tell if you've memorized something, or you can repeat a fact, or you can explain something, or draw a diagram, or something like that. And that's what these are, all right? And I think you have these on the front page of your lesson sheet, so we don't need to go through them, but I'll just tell you, it makes a great final exam, right? When you're all done, can you remember these things? They're just simple factual learning. It's not changing your heart, but I think if you don't have the facts that you synthesize into principles, that you turn into applications, and with conviction make a change in your life based on those ideas, then I think that's the way we learn, isn't it? You start with some facts, and you build on that. Especially if it comes from God's word and we're convicted to know that this truth should guide our lives. So I won't go through those, but I hope you see that each of those are achievable. Now, we might go through these right quickly. In fact, I think I will not. See, that's the thing. I need the keyboard to skip over these. So as we go through, you may know some of these. Is there a keyboard? No. Okay. For the sake of time, but I hope you'll, after having looked at them a little bit beforehand, you'll know to go back and put those in there. But these are the passages where I think you would go. So people are taking. I will make these charts available. I promise I will. In fact, they're downloaded on the desktop back there. In fact, I have a printout of like miniature version of those too. So, but you can take pictures all you. You can do it. What's that? Oh, the. Right, so here where we are. Let's start at the beginning. Turn over to Genesis 1 and 2. These are about as familiar probably as any text you could read, especially if you've ever been to a wedding where there was a preacher that kind of respected the truth of the Bible. And you notice that in the creation account there's chapter 1, in which there are a bunch of things. God said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, that word created doesn't really appear again, even through all those days of creation, until you get down to verse 26, 27, in which who's created? This will go faster if you kind of go ahead and answer. I know some questions are too easy to answer, some are too hard, but I'll try to get it right in the middle, right? But yeah, man was created. In fact, three times that word is used when you get down to verses 26 and 27. And I don't know that we know for sure all of what it means, but what was unique about the creation of man? He was different in some way. Yes. Yes, yeah, in the image of God. I think that's a little bit of a mystery. Sure, there's this plurality of the Godhead, and maybe this the image of God includes this idea of a kind of a maybe a unity in diversity, or however you want to say that. It could be that. I'm not sure. Let me just say a little bit about the book of Genesis. When was Genesis written? Like, was it written that day, the seventh day? No, it's not. Wasn't really quite an eyewitness account. Who wrote that? For whom? Children of Israel. Interesting. And where were they, roughly? I mean, where was Moses and the Israelites? Or maybe you could think, after Sinai, somebody, maybe this is written down. Why did they need a book of Genesis, a book of beginnings? Where had they been for 400 years? Now, not the same people. I know they didn't live for it. But, the generations over time, where had they been? In slavery in Egypt, not necessarily the center of Jehovah-centric thinking and that kind of thing. And here they come out without much of any kind of culture or understanding of what a person, a human is compared to a bull or something. Or what are the deities? How did the world get here? How do men and women relate? That kind of thing. What's wrong with the world? It does seem like twisted in some way. What's wrong with it? Is this what the gods intended or not? I'm making this up to some extent. You understand what I mean? But there are people that just don't have any kind of clue about who are we? And so part of that question is, what are humans, right? And are they different from animals or not? And not only that, who are Jewish or Israelites? Sorry, who are Israelites? Who are they? And where did we come from? And where did our ancestor used to live, by the way? What great ancestor, this covered starting in about chapter 12? Abraham. Who is that? And where did he live when he lived? By the way, where did he live? Well, that's where he started. But, where did kind of most of his adventures occur that we... Is there something special about Canaan's land, if you want to call it that, that the Israelites might need to know? That's their homeland. Doesn't feel like it after 400 years. I wasn't born there. I don't know anything about it. But there are cities there like Bethel. There's a story there. It's great. When you get there, you'll know the story behind that, right? And we're going to divide the land. You're going to learn. So the book of Genesis, I think about it, is just like this long story. It all occurred before the Israelites, but they're learning, who are we, right? And what are we special? And who was Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? And why are there kind of 12 divisions of us and all that kind of thing? Maybe they had orally passed that down. Do you see that maybe they needed this story about what is a human and what's a man and a woman and what's Jehovah? Who is Jehovah? What does he expect of us? Do we need that? Is that kind of a world we live in a little bit where people don't kind of know what a human is and what a man is and what a woman is and what their relationship ought to be and what was the plan from the beginning and what's wrong with the world? It feels wrong, doesn't it? Something's wrong. At least we imagine a world that ought to be better than it is, right? How did that happen, right? And so in that world then, how do we live as men and women? You see, that kind of be an important beginning. I think that's maybe why this story is there, as relevant probably to us as it would have been to them. So here's the story of the creation. And you can see that shortly, well, at least there's a recounting of this in chapter 2. And so there's a need that God seems to emphasize with this event where he calls the animals before this man who was created. And the woman's not there yet. And so you all know the story, right? The animals are called in. And what's Adam doing for the animals? I guess at God's instruction. He's giving them names. I wonder how he based his names. How did he decide what to call them? I'm thinking that there's some observation and some planning and some intelligence. Maybe he's thinking, I might name them after what they sound like. A snake, he probably didn't speak English, but or something like that, right? But the odd thing is, these sound waves that came out of his mouth, the symbols that eventually might be written on in written form, they don't actually look like the things they represent, do they? It's an abstract thing. We call it language. The animals were not naming Adam. Interesting, that wasn't happening. Who was naming that? So there's this dominance that's implied there, an intellectual dominance, an understanding. He starts to give them names. And that's kind of implied in this. Did he have something to do, by the way, to God early in the chapter 2 or late of chapter 1? Was there a task that Adam had? Or was it just kind of hammock in the garden, Tend the garden. And this, it really seems even more serious than that. What else was he supposed to do with regard to this creation? He was to have dominion over it. I don't know. Just think about that. Do you think that required some effort? Was it an active thing to do? I think if if Eden was a prefigure of heaven, I wonder if we'll have something to do in heaven. God said, you know, you've been faithful over a few things. The parable, what? What would happen? I want to set you over many. That doesn't sound like just playing harps on clouds. It sounds like they're... So I think we're built to have responsibility, and Adam had responsibility. Did it require initiative on his part? We're speculating, so there's no wrong answers. But did he have to work? Did he have to get up early maybe sometimes and do things on time and set a plan in place and maybe take a risk that it might fail the way he had it in mind and have to change to something else? I'm maybe stretching the point, but I'm telling you, Adam had something to do. He had some challenges to face. He needed some self-discipline maybe to get that work done. Now, he didn't have the opportunity to sin like we do, perhaps, except for one thing. But in general, I think he was a busy guy. He had purpose. He had work to do. It required some, initiative and planning and so on. Yep. Point. Right, I hope you can hear what he's saying. And when you're out in the rural or you're living off the land, maybe in a garden where you can pretty much eat anything, you think you punched the clock, said, I'm done? That's not my impression of the way farmers have ever lived, but you know that's kind of the idea. Yeah. So I think there was something missing. You know what it was. And maybe God was making it clear in this naming exercise. What was missing? A companion that was suitable to him, comparable, helper. And so that was created. And then this phrase that's going to be quoted again in the New Testament three times, and we're going to learn where that is and the points to be learned from where it's quoted, says they were what? What's the phrase that describes that unity? They were one flesh. Right. And so there was this relationship that it included the woman's role and the man's role. Now, is there some difference between them that's already there? We're not to chapter 3 yet. I'm telling you we're in chapter 2, okay? No fall yet. Is there anything implied about a difference in roles there? Yeah, can you ever hear that? One's a helper. It kind of starts to say there might be a lead role. Is that ever quoted again? We'll look at this. We'll get there. In the New Testament, the order of creation seems to have some significance in the role of men and women. Can you think of where that might be? Yeah, 1 Timothy 2, that's kind of saying, here's why. Well, because, you know, Adam was first. Now, he goes on to give another reason, too, but that's one of them that's listed there, right? All right, so what was man supposed to do again? He had a purpose with regard to the world, which was the earth, the garden, what? Have dominion, right? Did that come up? Or tend and subdue that way? He had that. And he was also told to do something else, which required a woman to do with him, which was what? What was the other thing? Yeah, brief, fruitful, multiply, and that implies that there would be children. Interesting, man, I don't know what God's plan was. People weren't dying yet, so I don't know. Were there just going to be so many children that'd be the end of the world, or what would happen? I don't know. It's kind of interesting. You wouldn't need to have as many, I guess, if parents kept on living. I don't know, but that's an interesting thought maybe to think about. So that's a kind of a nice picture, and I think that we'll kind of look at that picture as we go. Now, what happens is there's a fall. I think I've covered these points, and I got to keep going. There's implications, yes, so I think we've covered these things. Right. And so then there's the fall. And I think you know the story there, but who was given the instruction about the tree, the best we can tell from the way it's written? Who got the instruction directly from God's Adam? Seems to actually have been given maybe before the woman was created. And yet, when the serpent appeared, was she able to quote that command? Yeah, I should say, did she know it? She quoted it. She was able to know very precise. So how did she know that? Maybe she walked with God in the garden. Maybe Adam explained that to her. But she understood that was the command. And so there was a sin there. And she gave it. And it seemed like, and to her husband who was with her, Adam who was with her. I guess that implies he was standing by. Some think, well, he was off not doing his leadership role, and that's the problem. I don't know. But the point is, he was there and he also participated with her in that sin. Now everything starts to change. I'm not going to go into the details of this chart, but I do want to look at a few things that relate to the man-woman relationship. Think about relationships to God, to each other, to nature, and even to themselves. What are some of the consequences of that sin that's recorded in Genesis 3? What are some of those consequences? Pardon? Yeah, so yeah, with regard to the nature and so on, they had a rough time of it after that. Let's start with God. What's the relationship? What were changes? Relationship to God. Yeah, they were. There was, in fact, we kind of get almost a physical. I'm going to say before the fall, things were great. No guilt. They weren't unashamed. They had independent will. Over nature, they had dominion. The man and woman were perfectly suited. With regard to their self, there's no guilt or shame. Now there's a hint about what the fall would bring. With regard to God, yes, there's a separation. He walked with them in the garden. When he came back to do that again, they were hiding, right? And then it does seem that that personal relationship with God went away, didn't it? So after the fall, the relationship with God was withdrawn. They were guilty before God and drawn into the conflict between good and evil. With regard to the man and the woman, what was the consequence between the two of them? Anything go not too good? Right away. Right, you know, right away. It's God, this is the woman you gave me, did this, and, you know, the blame passing. And I think if you think about now all the things that happen as a result of this, they're spiritually divided. They have the potential to compete, blame each other for what's done there. They have the opportunity to be ashamed. I think the idea of deception probably enters the world, and a lot of the things that cause the problems between men and women. With regard to nature, I think you know about the thorns and thistles. It looked like every green thing can be eaten. At this point, though, some things not only were thorns that you couldn't eat, but also they were thorns that inhibited things you could eat. So the sweat of your face was required. And now it's not as easy to get by. And so there are potential shortages. There's a scarcity mentality. Y'all know what that scarcity mentality means? It means if I get something, then you're going to get less, right? If I get more, you get less. There's only this much food or the only this much money or whatever it is. And so that's going to cause competition perhaps. There's loss of dominion, there's thorns and thistles. And then with regard to self, of course, there's this guilt, shame, regret, complex, more complex moral choices, significance not assured. I'm taking too long with this. You understand the world was corrupted. So I'm going to go through these others. Sin is now more, but I just want to highlight a couple of things. I think now there's a chance that the roles are corrupted. Things that were perfectly suited before because of this change in relationship with God and with our own conscience, our own selves, and with regard to nature, there's more opportunity for temptation, more opportunity for selfishness, for deception, for shame, for other sins that we might wish to hide, and therefore we're deceptive about that. And that's what happens. And so the roles are somewhat corrupted, and there's the potential to compete. And the roles themselves, this helper, head kind of a role, now can be an opportunity for sin and temptation. So here, let's go back to the picture again. So what does God say to the woman, particularly? I actually start with the man, just because that's the way the graphic's going to come up. Sorry, but okay, so for the man, what was, after the sin, God starts listing some things that are going to be different, right? You remember those verses in chapter 3? I think we all know these. What are some of them? What does he say the man will do as a result of this fall? Pardon? Well, so he's going to toil by the sweat of his face. Yes, that's right. That's the problem with PowerPoint. I have the order set already. So, with regard to the woman, what's going to happen? What does it say? The woman will have childbirth, that's that, and man has the sweat of his face. With regard to their relationship, key verse there, it's corrupted. Her desire shall be to her husband, and he shall rule over you. Let me just ask this question. Were those things good, or were they bad? I mean, generally. The sin has happened, and God said, here are all the things that are going to happen. Pain and childbirth, thorns and thistles, desire to your husband, he will rule over you. You think those are thought of as good things? I don't think so. He's saying, you know, if it didn't happen, if this sin had not occurred, this particular set of bad things wouldn't be happening. Now, I don't know for sure what all that they mean, but I don't think it's good. I think it's a corruption of what the world was, part of the consequence of that sin. So we can argue about that. This is part of the macho thing. I like it when somebody argues with me because I think I can win, but maybe not. But the point is, the man was told that he would rule over the woman. Does that mean he's commanded to do that, or that just might happen as a result of this sin? Or it could be a temptation that he has to do that. I don't know. These are questions at the end. And the woman, as you said, her desires to the husband. What does that mean? Does anybody have some ideas about that? Okay, all right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. So, yeah, right. We certainly observe that women have a more people-oriented mentality about things. And in this picture, you can kind of see that too. If you look at where the arrows go, and maybe I've just drawn the picture, but the woman's kind of the centerpiece in childbearing. You think you could say that. And her other role is helper to her husband. Whereas the man is kind of outward facing. He was before this dominance. And you're going to see that in the penalties too. What's the penalty of the woman? What does it have to do with? Bearing children. What's the penalty of the man? What does it have to do with? Working, doing things is harder now. You know, that kind of thing. So there is a sense in which the women are people oriented. Yeah, Brent. All of this is speculation. Let's be clear about that, okay? So, okay. The rule over or the desire? Okay. Yeah, right. In fact, there's a desire and you must rule over it, almost like a similar... So it's a help. Does it say, you know, her desire will be to rule her husband? The thing that about that little parallel to chapter 4, it's a little bit of a problem. It's almost like Cain is told, but you need to fight against that desire by ruling over it. Maybe that's what this is about. Like, this woman has this desire for you, but you should fight against that by pushing back and ruling against that. So I'm not saying the words aren't the same. They might mean the same, but I have trouble making the exactly overlay. And the other question I'll ask again is, are these good things or bad things? I mean, just to think about the context. Are these things that would create more danger for sin or less? Are they things that God's commanding them to do now, new commandments? Like you should rule over your wife. That's the new command. And the wife is going to have a desire for her husband. That's her command. So whatever they mean, yeah. Okay. Does God ever, as a result of sin, place stumbling blocks that are the consequence of that sin to create other opportunities for sin? Say, in Israel's life when they failed to drive out the nations around them, what was going to happen when they didn't do that? I mean, lots of problems, right? So I think it is the case. Sometimes sin has a cascading effect. Maybe that's true here. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And so I'm going to stop arguing at this point, I guess. But I'm except after I say this because I get the last word, I guess. Okay. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Desire.
Yeah. Which
you see this in relationships,
can that be unhealthy even,
yeah,
the way they're drawn to? So I don't see these as healthy, helpful things. Whatever they mean, it seems to me they're consequences of sin that make the world even more tricky. And we need to have answers for that. And we're going to come back to this diagram when we get to Ephesians 5 and other verses and say, how do we overlay on this the solution that Jesus gives us as we fight, struggle with evil and the corrupted world, that the fallen world we live in? But I don't think if we don't see this kind of as the problem we're addressing and what informs our natural man, I think we're maybe missing the key lesson, even though I don't know for sure what it means, but... Yes, and, just a few theories maybe. If you look at the cycle of an abused woman, it's amazing that she has drawn back to the very man who is the source of harm in her life. Why is that? It's something in her nature. And the more she tries to draw him in and he feels, constricted and like he's losing control, what is his response often? You see? It's that, I'm going to rule over you. I'm going to dominate. In fact, if you look, there's another way to think about this too. What was going to be, I didn't finish the drawing, the curse with regard to the earth was he would toil. You see, he has to work harder to conquer the world too. And he might get confused to think that he has to conquer the woman as well in the same way, with the same sweat and the same effort and the same kinds of struggle. You see that? Now maybe that's another way to look at it. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I just think that's an example of a broken world. And he is giving in to those natural desires to be in control, right? Just like he wants to control nature. And I think it is difficult for women who are dependent in some ways for their identity and security to give up on a guy, even as worthless as he might be. I'm not approving all that. I'm just telling you, we live in a broken world. And that's one of the, I call it the spiral. I've seen it, where there's just, this abuse, and then there's this kind of reconciliation, and then the guy feels constrained, and he lashes out. But I think it can happen in miniature form for us, too. If we're not giving our wives what they need, is it possible that they reach out and try to grab it from us? Like, I need more time with you. Right? You're not doing the things you used to do. I'm not sure you love me anymore. Maybe there's tears. Maybe there's silence. Maybe there's something like that. I'm way ahead in the lessons here, but I'm just trying to illustrate this. And how do we respond to that thing where somebody's trying to control my life? Are you going out again tonight? Wherever I go, I get a call. So when are you coming home? Right there in front of all the guys in the football game of all things. And how do I respond to that? That desire to pull me in, to know where I am, to be secure in the relationship. How do I respond to that? How does the natural man respond to that, let's say? Pull away. And does that help or make it worse? We're in a spiral here. You see that? And I think you can almost see the spiral here where she's has this need that's not being fulfilled and he's having this threat that he has to rule over and it makes it worse and worse. Now, I have never really defined it. I'm just trying to tell you this is the broken world and we've got to break that. And we're going to see later, come back to this drawing and when we get to Ephesians 5. So I've probably oversold this whole idea, but there's something bad in the world as a result of that. There's a relationship change within the one flesh unity, and there's a relationship change within the external environment. You see that? That's what it is. It was that before the fall. Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, right. Right. So there's a whole lesson that works that you could think about, and that is, imagine the garden family before the fall. What was their relationship with God? He was there with them. He was present. They saw him. What was their relationship with each other? Well, it was this perfect unity. They worked together. So my question is, and this is an application lesson we won't get to, is there any way we can recreate that garden family before the fall? I think that's what you're getting at, right? They were one flesh before the fall. How can I go back? How can I have that close relationship with God when he walks in the garden? Both of us are there listening and knowing his. Well, I can't recreate that, but I can get close. I can do things with his word, with our devotion, with our understanding that God is present with us. Right. Same thing in the relationship. Yeah. Could be. Like I say, I just conclude there's something not exactly healthy about this desire. And I think the Genesis 4 reference is maybe a hint about that as well. But I've stretched this point way too far already. Sin is selfish. Okay. Yeah, suddenly. Right. That's interesting, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, interesting point. So whatever the rule is, right, good. Yeah, it's good. So if you think about it, whatever the desire for the man is, whatever the rule is, aren't those kind of self-centered desires? That's a very good point. Thank you. Yeah, okay. So I think, now we're going to speculate even more, but I think these are things we've observed. Are there differences between men and women in the world today, present world, which includes the before and after fall things, the good things God put as well as the corruption of those things? Yeah, there are. And I've tried to use pink and blue, but it didn't come out real well. Pink didn't, anyway, but you get it. And I think we've experienced these things. I think if you don't believe these or haven't observed them, you skip over the one you don't believe, or my wife's not like this, that's fine. But I think this is pretty typically observed. Are men and women different at a macroscopic level? I mean, look different, muscle size. Do they have different organs? So kind of medium macro level. Yeah, do they have different, like, chemistry? Is that true? Do they have, like, different, are they different at, like, a molecular level? As it turns out, chromosomes and things like that. Yeah, it turns out, yeah, they're actually, so from the littlest thing to the biggest thing, they're kind of different from a physical point of view. I wonder if that doesn't reflect itself in behaviors and other things like that. So here are some ideas. You know these, and they're fun to talk about in some ways. I think women in general seek security and affection, and maybe the balance or the equivalent on the man's side is we seek accomplishment and approval. Now, it doesn't mean women don't need approval, but you understand, and I think in their lives it may be a greater need for security and safety and maybe this nurturing protection than, say, the man who wants to have approval and respect. The woman, as you might know, often values the experience, whereas the man is thinking about accomplishing something as we go through. My accomplishment goal is to finish this material by tomorrow at lunch tomorrow, but anyway, I hope maybe the experience will be worthwhile. The woman is after stable relationships. The man might have more of an inclination to control things, to have things under control. The woman wants, in her world, feelings are more significant. In the man, maybe we are more interested in logic and black and white. And I'm not going to defend these to a large degree, but you've had this kind of thing. If you're married very long, you know this is the case. Parallel spiral approach to thinking about things, maybe revisiting topics and so on. If you're a man, that will annoy you to death. If you want to say, we've already covered this, right? Are we back? We're talking about this again? I thought we'd gotten that behind us. But we're kind of circling back, and you know, we want to get to the end. We want to accomplish. We want to get this thing solved. The focus is on feelings as opposed to the events and facts. Versatile emotions, volatile emotions are okay. Tears are kind of more normal, more natural. I think I'm seeing that as my, maybe it's my testosterone level diminishes. I have more tears now, but maybe that's, but anyway, I think all through that's okay. And for men, are often emotional control is admired. And this is, you've had this experience, how it's said is paramount, what is said is paramount for the men. You know, I really do have a photographic memory of whatever I said to Mary. I'm telling you, I remember exactly what I said. But she would say I said stuff that I didn't say. I really didn't say it. And I'm really convinced I did not say the very words she's repeating to me. But you know what she's remembering is how she felt when I said it, which often was more accurate than the literal words I said. Y'all know what I mean by that? My expression, my tone, the context, those kind of things. Yeah, I was careful to say words that I'd remember later. I could say, oh, I didn't say that, and I said this other thing. But the real communication happened on an emotional level, and probably the way she repeated it back in words, even though the words were not accurate, was closer to what actually said. Yeah. I think they value the experience would be the way they do. I don't value the experience. I have a goal. I'm going to get there.
And, but when a man goes shopping, he is goal-oriented, mm-hmm. and he knows what he needs to get. Okay. And he goes directly to the item that he gets. He doesn't bother about the price or anything that way too there. He gets home, and the wife is always upset because he spent more money than she would have spent on the same items and things that way too there. Mom and I do that all the time.
Yeah.
When she goes shopping, she takes two or three hours. When I go, I'm 15 minutes, I'm in and out of store. And I get the same amount of things, and I spend more money than she does for the same items.
I can't prove these differences are absolute from Bible scripture. I think that picture that I showed before has some indication that men are more thing-oriented and women are more people-oriented. But it certainly is our experience, and I think that's part of the wisdom we can convey. And our wives are all different from each other, and maybe that's the 1 Peter 3 comment, you know, verse 7, 8, that we're dwell with your wives according to knowledge. You've got to figure that out. But there will be these differences, and I don't say these are good or bad either, but I do say that they create in each of us different kinds of temptations. And we're going to come back to that in just a minute, how the nearly blue things on this list do create a kind of a temptation. Yes, sir. I can't fully understand it all because it's just too confusing to me. But we live in a world that's just corrupted. And I'm saying it's like those poor Israelites that had been in Egypt and had no idea. And that's the world we live in. There was a while, I think I sensed it, you know, when I was working in industry, that it was forbidden to ever admit that there was any difference between men and women. Do y'all remember that? Well, now it's not quite that way. It's kind of like, well, diversity is the best thing in the world, so let's have as much difference in high, but still it's difficult when the differences are highlighted, sometimes even based on research, you know. I never know if I'm supposed to agree with this or not, you know, or what am I supposed to do with that. And women in positions of authority, I think, is kind of not the Bible plan, but that's the way this world is working, and I don't fully know how to respond to that. I hope you didn't come looking for those answers. But I do think we should remember we're in a world that has lost sight of where we came from and what we are. And the differences that God created in men and women and the roles that he gave us for our benefit, for our good. I'll stop there, but we can say some more as we go forward. And that's where I am. I'm just confused, right? And now we can actually declare we're not men or women if we want to, and we're not men or women anymore. So I'm just totally confused.
Listen, I love you, and I'm So just focus on the content and not the tone. Just look past the tone part, listen to the content, and then we'll be square.
Sure, right.
That's not going
to
help.
Yeah, and it's a really kind of a selfish way to say it. We actually had a class last night, men's class, and one of the guys, we were talking about what makes us angry, and he was just saying, he talks to his wife, and she says, "You sound so angry." You know, his thought was, he kind of repeated, he says, "You don't know what angry sounds like." You know, it's like, I have not started yet, you know. Probably not the best response to that, but anyway. Well, so we have to deal with this. So here we are, we're in a fallen world. And you know what Cain did, right? Not too long after this. Was Cain well motivated? What was the problem with the offering? Was this maybe challenging some of his male seeking approval and accomplishment and successful things? His brother, I guess younger brother, right, had a better sacrifice. And that made him angry. It made him angry enough to kill his brother. Not a good start, right, for how that goes. I'm going to put some of the lineage of Cain in the context of the differences in men and women. And we keep reading in chapter 4, and Cain built a city. I don't know if that's sinful or not, but I suspect it wasn't the best thing to do based on some other things in the list. He not only built a city, but what did he do? He named it Trump Tower. He named it after his family name, right? Or you know what I mean? Why would a person name something after themselves or their son or something? So that happened. And then Lamech, a couple of generations later, had two wives. Good idea? Why did he have two wives? Why would a man get two wives? That wasn't the plan. One flesh, you know, all that kind of stuff. Pardon? I think he just wanted two wives. And he could. He could do it. And a man could have two wives. Probably wasn't the case that a woman could have two husbands. And you know, but he could do it. He could do it by measure of strength or affluence or whatever he could do. He could control the situation. And it matched his desire, and so he did it. That's what he did. Jabel, tents and ownership of cattle. I don't know what to make of that. But I wonder, was there actually ownership in terms of property and counting up how many cattle you had, and these are mine and those are not, you know, and I don't know. Was that a new introduction into the world? This is all following there in chapter 4. Musical instruments, right? I could say, theorize about that, but I mean, we had a musical instrument God gave us, and I think the worship might have been good with that. There's metallurgy, tools, accomplishment, right? Science that's progressing along in the descendants of Cain. Lamech. With relation to, he had two wives, but interesting that he, do you remember the verse about that? He had a role model, interestingly. Somebody apparently nudged him or did something that he didn't like, and so what did he do? 77-fold revenge. Yeah, or whatever. Yeah, right. And who was his role model? Not only was his role model, he said, "I'm going to do better than Cain," right? Cain just kind of killed one guy. Right, for something. I'm better than that. 77-fold revenge. Because he was a real man, right? And when somebody messes with me as a real man, what do I do? And if I respond in the right way, guess what's going to happen to the next guy that thinks about messing with me, right? In the descendants of Cain. Yeah, Cain is a role model. And then Seth died and a bunch of other people died as you get on into chapter 5 until finally... Methuselah, the oldest man, it looks like he died in the year of the flood. I don't know. Might have lived longer. But then there's this physical attraction. These are not the descendants of Cain anymore. Well, I mean, they're involved, but the men there, what is driving them to this kind of ungodly kind of connection? And it's their lust, right? They were desirable. These women were. And so that's driving them in not in the best direction and so on. So wickedness was great, and we came to the flood. Look at these characteristics of men, and tell me what are some of the temptations that come from that. How can these maybe good qualities, maybe created qualities, maybe just inherent qualities, how do they become stumbling blocks to us? Do they? If this is... Seek approval and respect, not necessarily a bad thing. I think God fulfills that when he will finally say one day, well done, thou good and faithful servant. But how do we abuse that? How does it go to seed? And fear of others of us, right? Yeah. And that approval and respect may be desired whether I deserve it or not, right? And there's a sense of pride if I'm not respected in some way. You see, I'm going to go through these verses, but you see the idea is that these inclinations become temptations for us. They do. And they can be corrupted. Let's think about that. Okay, so proud and self-centered. If we're goal-oriented and focused on accomplishment, it may be that winning is paramount and we disrespect losers. I'm going to struggle not to mention a particular political candidate who is the perfect example of almost everything down the right-hand column. Right? Have you heard anybody who just continues to say, I'm a winner and they're losers? Right? Or and other kinds of things like that. Who, when he's touched, strikes back in a kind of a harsh way as an example of the kind of, just a good example of that. We'll not talk about that too much. But I always want to be right, whether I deserve to be or not. With regard to linear thinking, the temptation is that I'm impatient. I'm not tolerant with people who want to talk about it or have some measure of indecision or hesitation or risk aversion in some way. So I actually run over people. I'm callous to human concerns because I'm focused on the facts. We're just trying to get the job done. Why are you slowing us down? We don't need to talk about this anymore. I suppress sympathy because I admire emotional stability. I see emotions as weakness. I see some kind of a sympathy and soft heart as some kind of a weakness. I'm not approving these things, but do you see those are temptations that men can have? With their children, for example, with their wives, with the members of a congregation who are babes in Christ, and they're just not doing what they should do. And finally, I could be brutish or I could be cruel in the way I talk. You see, these are temptations that we have that I think grow out of the nature that God has given us that makes us male, and yet they lead us in a way that could be a temptation. Yeah.
They can lead to temptation, but also some of them can be an attribute to leadership as well. I mean, you were in the corporate world, and I'm sure that you probably were in charge of other people, and if you had a manager or a subordinate that was indecisive,
so I just need to get angry and yell at somebody. So this is the very tension point that I want us to wrestle with over the next day, and that is there is a picture that the world has of what real men are. And sometimes they just have to lose their temper, or they just have to take a stand, or they just have to defend themselves, or you know what I mean? I'm not saying you said that. I'm just saying, y'all know what I'm talking about? And we can take that as just like the way it is. Or we can look in the scriptures and say, what are we supposed to do with those inclinations? Because are they real inclinations to want to accomplish, to want to be approved of? They are. They're there. God made those, I think. How do we use them? And even the idea of winning or conquering. We're going to see, guess who God made to be soldiers in the Old Testament? Did they fight wars? Was there violence involved? Was there courage involved? What happened to that? Are we supposed to act that way every day? Y'all see the dilemma. These are not simple answers, but I want to wrestle with that. We have a nature that comes from the creation and from the fall, among other things. And there's some of that that God made to be used and as instruments of strength in his kingdom. And some of it is a huge source of temptation. We got to sort that out. I don't have all the answers, but I think we need to look at that problem and figure it out. And the question you asked is just an example of that. I remember I had an interview for a job I didn't get. This was internal to Georgia Tech, and everything's open. There's a huge committee and all that. And they're saying, in your view, with regard to this organization, what do you think your biggest strength is? I said, well, I don't cuss and I don't get angry. And so the next question was, well, what's your biggest weakness? with regard to this organization. And I said, well, I don't cuss and I don't get angry. And, you know, there's something to that. I think some people almost expect you to be, you know, that when the time's needed, you got to come down. But anyway, yeah. Yeah.
All the way back.
Yeah.
So in that going through the race, you're seeking approval and respect, but when you were at the finish line, God was already.
It was done.
Approved.
Yeah, it was there.
God was already
yeah.
respect.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
God was already in control of things. So
yeah.
You had it all right there. But now, being in the fall, going through all of the turmoil, it's like man understood that about God. And they almost, in a sense, to make themselves a God.
Yeah.
Per se, because now you seeking approval.
Yeah.
Now you being self-centered. Now you trying
yeah.
to dominate. So God is the one who dominates.
That's a great, I'm going to paraphrase this way. All those things that were complete are now just so incomplete. And we try to fill them up. And do we do them with the right things? Right? Is it accomplishment? Is it recognition? Is it control? They were complete. And now they're not. And we want to fill them up. We still have that nature that wants to do it and have it. But we also have these other things that confuse that. This is, I'm not answering any questions, but I think if we don't see ourselves in a spiritual warfare, we're missing the point. That's a little bit of a theme when we come to rearing children and other things. If we think we're just kind of naturally suited for this world and that's the way it'll work out, God placed, we're not in the garden anymore, folks. That's my point in a way. And those, yes. I don't say that these things down the right, all of these are righteous or all of these are sinful. I'm just saying that this nature, which I think I see in myself, creates a temptation. And I've got to figure out, on the one hand, how to not sin. On the other hand, how to direct those inclinations as in as much as they're right toward what God. Right. Yeah. Okay. Moving ahead, I hope you're finding things to fill in these lesson sheets. I don't know. I'm trying to follow a little bit but you can. Oh, by the way, I just put through on here some qualifications. You might recognize some of these as the opposites of those temptations. You recognize these qualifications there? Not puffed up, not self-willed, not quarrelsome, not quick-tempered, gentle, good behavior, not violent. You recognize those as important. So I'm gonna venture out into some sociology literature. It's somewhat old, but I found this, and I thought, this is kind of experimental evidence and a theory that kind of matches. This is an explanation of this, of course, in their mind would be totally dysfunctional, macho mentality. How do men get to this point? This is an abstract of the article, but I'll just say, this is what they say leads to this macho. By the way, just to kind of summarize, I'll show on the next chart. Here's what drives this machismo. It descends from the ideology of the warrior and stratifications, that is, somebody wins, somebody loses, following warfare, all right? He says, or she says, I think, victor and vanquished, master, slave, head of the house, woman is the complement, the patriarch and his children. And before you get kind of upset to say she's saying marriage in the heads, didn't we read about that in the account of the fall? This idea of the patriarch or the head of the house and the woman, that really was one of the results of the fall and the sin. Not a good, I mean, there was something else that was good, but there was something that wasn't good. So anyway, and keep on reading. The personality script of the macho man is ideology of machismo, mutually amplify one another, justifying his lifestyle and celebrating his worldview in his dangerous adversarial world of scarce resources. Does that sound familiar? And that is one response to a fallen world where things don't go well. And if you don't strike first, you get struck. If you don't dominate, somebody dominates you. Do you know that mentality? I think we can see that in certain communities maybe more overtly, but I think it's everywhere. It's in the corporate world and other places. Or if you don't dominate somebody, it's a scarcity. You're not the vanquished. If you're not the victor, you're the vanquished. Those are the choices. And you got to live in that kind of a world. And that's the script that I think many men live by. Either in an explicit way, in a gang environment, or in an implicit way, maybe more in a business world. And so here's the way this works. There's unrelieved expressions. They're finally relieved as anger. I would probably put the word temper in there, just to think about it. More of this outward expression of anger, which intimidates people. The fear expression and fear avoidance are inhibited. I hold those in, and I reverse them then. And I get excitement and pride created by being aggressive and by doing daring things, right? I'm always thinking of the famous last words, "Hey, guys, watch this," right? You know that joke, right? That's the idea. Pride, then, from these aggression and daring activities leads to disgust for inferiors, effeminate, for sissies, and all girls who don't live this way, right? So I have a disgust for that. And you probably have, if you went to junior high, if they have that here, you could see that beginning to grow in adolescence, where there were certain, you know, dominant guys. They were the athletes. They were the tough guys. They were the intimidators, bullies in our kind of world thinking now. And they actually express this kind of dominance, you know, by intimidating others. And in this world of scarcity, there's only so many big guys and, you know, big kids and strong guys. Everybody else is suppressed in that way. And so power, pride, and glory replaces these things. Interpersonal control is exercised through anger and daring dominance. You want to meet me outside after class? You know, this kind of, you know, have y'all seen this? Is this one model at least of what masculinity is? Surprise becomes an interpersonal strategy. I lose my temper. People are afraid to talk to me, afraid to attack, afraid to disrespect me in any way. And I'm actually dominating. I'm living the ruling role in the world. Right? I'm not advocating this. I'm just telling you this is not a Christian. This is a sociology paper saying how this script is built. And excitement or winning and conquering is magnified as acceptable over just kind of enjoying something in a relaxed way. Why do we like football? Thank you. He doesn't. But. Yeah. And it's not, you just win by kind of being real clever and moving your chess piece around in just the right way. Yeah. Oh, you have to be clever too. That's just part of the game. But you got to be tough, and you can't. You don't. You got to have the, you know, the attitudes. I'm just saying to you. I think we have some surrogate activities that sound a little bit like this, maybe, and we should think about it. I hope our life in that. But anyway, the script that acts all this out is callous sexual attitude, violence is manly, and danger as the way to excitement. This is the world talking, right? I sometimes think. That, what was it Jesus said, the sons of this world are wiser than the sons of light or something. But that's a problem. Now, having said that, can you think of some men in the Bible that kind of acted out some of that stuff? Oh, Samson comes to mind right away. All three of those, I guess, right? Right? Callousness towards sex and all that. But let's kind of go in chronological order. We already discussed Cain, right? I think Cain falls in that category. He expressed his anger. That's how he did it in murder. We mentioned I'll tell you the incident in David's life. You could probably guess this too. What's the incident in David's life that comes to mind? His counterpart's going to be on my list up here, but yeah, Nabal and Abigail. You remember that story? Now, Nabal's a better example of this, I think, maybe than David, but David responded in kind, didn't he? You know how that works. So here's some. Esau, who for a mess of porridge and so on, he was the outdoor guy. He's a fisher, hunter, you know, masculine kind of guy. He liked all that outdoor stuff. And Jacob, you know, was an indoor guy. He liked cooking and, you know, things like that. Simeon and Levi, remember that story? Dinah and they, and you remember that story? They just decided they as a family had to protect their reputation and their pride, and they end up killing a whole village of people over, I mean, a bad thing happened, but their idea of revenge was to kill all the men. Interesting to me that after they killed them, you go read that story, you know what they did with the wives of those men they killed? They took them, right? So they responded in kind. Not a great story. Defending their honor. Samson, you already mentioned there. Had a big ego. Saul, remember Saul? We could talk some more about that. Nabal, we talked about that already. Rehoboam. Remember Rehoboam? What's the best way to make sure that these people don't kind of rebel against you? You got to crush them, right? My little finger. And so he had to... Actually, two sets of advisors to choose between. But his idea was, if you're not tough enough, then somebody's going to take advantage of you, right? That was his view of things. Not good examples. Another? I didn't, but I should, right? These are just ones that came to my mind, but just to give you the idea that that's what's happening. I think that in your lesson... Well, actually, I'll go a little bit farther, and then we'll get to the... So how do we respond to this? This is a godly male character. It is the case that despite this terrible track record of men and their ability to do the right thing and to act the right way and to deal with these temptations, who was given all these spiritual and family and governmental and religious leadership roles? Why is that? I wonder sometimes if women wouldn't have made better spiritual leaders and so on. I was thinking about this. We had a Lord's Supper lesson, and I wonder. I was just looking at the abuse of Caiaphas and Herod and Pilate, although he kind of was more of a wimp maybe than others. I wonder if there had been women in charge if that would have happened that way. You know, beating Jesus, making fun of him, all that. I don't know. I don't know. I do know Pilate's wife sent him a letter. Remember that? I'm way off. But I think sometimes that men gone wrong is way worse in some ways in leadership roles than maybe women would ever end up doing. And yet God's given them these roles. Look at these. You know these. They're fathers. They're elders. And by the way, these are not elders in the New Testament church. These are the elders of Israel. They were already organized. And who did Moses go to when he went to go say, I'm here to lead you out of the promise, out of Egypt to the promised land? He went to the elders. They were advocates of the group and so on. The priests were men. The governors, the commanders, the captains, officers, the judges that came up and the teachers were all men. These were their roles. So what were their qualifications? And I have, this is more, and prophets, of course, speaking for God. This next chart is really more what's in your book there. When I look at these leaders and look at the qualifications, sometimes they're actually listed. Abraham, for example, and this is the theme verse that I tried to use there. This was the incident in before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And you almost can hear God thinking to himself, should I keep this a secret from Abraham? Because I have known him. Another translation is I've chosen him. And that seems to match because later, there's a later quote of this verse where it seems to be saying this is in the time of Nehemiah. The people are repenting, and they're offering this prayer, and they're recounting all the things God has done. And one of the things he did is he chose Abraham because he could keep his children faithful. ESV says chose here, but other translations are they've known. It's the common word for knowing. But I have known him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. What's the qualification Abraham had to be the father of the nations? Yeah, it was his faith in God. We might have listed some other things. You remember Moses was wearing himself out. Remember that with all these squabbles? I have an idea that people know how to get along, and plus they're camping out, which always is a little bit stressful, right? You're out of the away from home, and nothing's really going right. And so there's all kind of issues, and Moses is just, I think Jethro says something like that. You're wearing yourself out. And he says, here's a suggestion. Go pick some men. Those were judges that were going to offload Moses from dealing with the people. What were their qualifications? Here's the verse. You shall select from all the people able men Now, I think that's the description of what an able man is follows. One of the translations just has a dash that is, here are these things that make them able. What would make a man able as a judge? I would first think maybe he's clever, you know, he, like Solomon, can divide the baby or whatever. But look at what's said. They fear God. They're men of truth. They hate covetousness. And these are the ones we want to have as rulers over these thousands. Do you see that? And David, selected by Samuel, and you know this verse, the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And what did David actually look like on the outside when this was said about him? King? No, a young guy. Probably courageous and other things about him, but he didn't look like a ruler so much that his dad didn't even bother to bring him into the tryout, you know. So that's one thing said. Solomon, this is something that that David said to Solomon. My son Solomon, you're about to become king. This is what his advice he gave him. He says, know the God of your father, serve him with a loyal heart, with a willing mind, because the Lord searches the hearts and understands all the intents of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. Consider now, for the Lord has chosen you. Now, the rest of that is to build the temple. But still, God chose Solomon to have that special role. Why? What did Solomon have to do to qualify himself to do that? He had to be the best statesman there was. He had to be a great negotiator with all the other nations, right? He had to rule everybody and be a great organizer and all of that. Is that kind of the core competence that is being stated by David here? It's elders. We just read through that list. I think I put some things in the lesson sheet. Does it ever say elders need to like be really clever people? They need to actually have a lot of initiative. They need to be creative. They need to be closers. They need to be action-oriented. They need to be customer-oriented. Is any of that in those qualifications? Any of those words I just said? Sometimes we think of the elders that are going to be leading, they're leaders. What leaders need to be is, they need to be pushing people and they need to... When you look at the qualifications, they're a boring list of things, aren't they? Have you noticed how many of them are not something? Right? Can you think of some? Not a novice, not soon angry, not given to much wine, husband of one wife. You know, these are... If you were looking for a CEO, that would not be the list you'd probably start with, would you? If you were looking for somebody to lead a company or lead an army or something like that, that would not be, y'all see what I'm getting at? In fact, we seem to be able to ignore that. If a man's been married three times and he's been abusive and deceptive in his business, and everything, that doesn't seem to matter as long as he's saying great political things. I'm back on that again. I'm sorry. But I just think that's where we are in this world. People don't look at the nature of a man's character, and yet every one of these, where does God start with his leader qualifications? It's on the inside. It's their faith in God. It's their strength that comes from that relationship. And how better to deal with a confusing world that we don't really understand. Prayer leaders, I skipped the proto-deacons. Were they actually looking for good cooks to feed the Grecian widows? Or good accountants that could keep track of where all the food went? Is that what they said in the qualifications? What are the qualifications for these deacons, or proto-deacons, or whatever you want to call them, the deacon tables? What was the qualification? Good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom. And we're going to point them over this matter. I don't know if they have experience in distribution of... You see what I'm getting at here? Keep going. Prayer leaders. We want men who are articulate, who are well-versed in Scripture, who understand the nature of prayer. What does Paul say these men who prayer leaders ought to be, first of all? The ones who pray, they should lift up holy hands. That's what, and without a wrathful temper, without disputing or argument, whatever that phrase means. It seems to me, I keep seeing in these qualifications, I think there may be one more, teachers. There was one I added, and this is a file that didn't get updated. I actually went back and looked at the soldiers in the Old Testament. You remember Moses, there were some, you remember you had to kind of serve in the army. Do you know there were qualifications for those soldiers? Do you remember some of them? I believe the reference is Deuteronomy, I want to say it's 20 or else Numbers 20. I can't remember. Yes, that's one. If they'd been married or betrothed, they didn't have to go. If they were married for like a year, they didn't have to go. So that's one. Well, that's a qualification. Maybe that's an exemption, but right. But there was one qualification, and Gideon used it. Gideon was told to use this qualification to decide who could go to the battle and who couldn't. Remember that qualification? You got it. They're not afraid. They're not faint-hearted. That's what the qualification. It wasn't that they could sling a sling with either hand, or, you know, it was that they weren't faint-hearted. Because what was God going to use in the battle? It wasn't going to be military might. It was going to be not faint-hearted men. You see that? And I think that's an interesting, I wish it had made on here. Teachers, you can see what Paul said to Timothy and those kind of things. But do you all see the point I'm making with this? When you look at the leadership roles, I think the qualifications that come up front have more to do with character than they do the specific competencies related to that particular role. And is it true that when we're motivated well and trusted well, that oftentimes our mistakes in some execution form can be overlooked by those led? They know we're well-motivated and honest people. So here are some roles in the New Testament. I'm going to come back to these qualifications, just a point we made before. And I look in the New Testament, and there are role differences. For example, in 1 Corinthians 11, there's this sequence, God, Christ, man, and woman. That's one of those passages that's in the quiz. It doesn't mean that Christ is any inferior to God or that the woman is inferior to man, but there is this sequence of... And his reason for that is the woman was created from the man and for the man. That goes back to before the fall in the Genesis account. That was the beginning of that order, I think is what he's saying. In Ephesians 5, the husband is the head of the wife. And that quotes, of course, the passage before the fall about the one flesh. Now, 1 Timothy 2, which you mentioned before, actually looks before the fall and after the fall to say women are not to teach. And the reason is that she was first formed, and also she was beguiled in sin. So there, whatever that means, there were really two reasons there. And finally, this restriction in 1 Corinthians 14 perhaps related to the exercise of spiritual gifts, but I think general guidance for worship, not a God of confusion, but of order, right? We should live in a certain way. He says, as also saith the law. I don't know for sure what that means. I think it just means this is the way it was set up in the Old Testament. And so that's still appropriate today, is the way God set it up. I think that's what that means. Not that there's some quote from the Ten Commandments that would justify what Paul is saying. So that's kind of a picture. So let's go back to thinking about character for just a minute. If I look in the New Testament, and I can look at passages that refer to men or older men or younger men, and you probably know where those passages are, 1 Timothy 2, Titus 2 has a list of those. Let's look at what some of those are. And also the qualifications of elders and deacons. Holy hands and prayerful, without anger or argument. Do you see how these are in contrast a little bit to the macho character? Right? I'm concerned about purity. I'm in control of my temper and those kind of things. Sober, self-controlled. Examples of integrity. Respectable. Titus 2, these are all related to the younger men. There's an earlier passage there in that chapter about older men. Sound speech of the younger men. And then when I look more specifically at the home relationship, I see these things. Ruling or managing the house with gravity. Sacrificial love, we'll say a lot more about that later. Not bitter or harsh, a parallel passage in Colossians 3. Dwelling with their wives according to knowledge, 1 Peter 3. Giving honor to the wives. Do you remember the contrast about the macho man? What is his thinking about weak objects? Weak people, indecisive people, vulnerable people. They're not highly respected, right? Not valued. Peter seems to be saying, no, 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 it's the other way around. You respect the woman because of that vulnerability or that weakness or whatever that is, the weaker vessel. And not disrespect her for that. Not provoking children or discouraging them. Colossians 3, that might be done by temper, by the way. It might be done by unpredictable responses. I'm really mad today because I'm in a bad mood. Tomorrow you can get away with anything. So they're totally frustrated. They don't know what the rules are. The world is not orderly for them. So I'm nurturing, chastening, and admonishing the children, and so on. And if you look at the more general discussion, the fruit of the Spirit, as well as the wisdom that's from above in James chapter 3, look at some of these words. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Do you see a little bit of a conflict between that and the macho world, the picture that we saw before? Wisdom from above is pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy, good fruits, without partiality, and so on. You see that challenge that we have in a fallen world against about our nature. So you should be able to find in the book a little survey. And I hope some of these thoughts are kind of there. I'd like you to do some introspection and go through these questions. And the answers are a little tricky because, and I've tried to show blue and white, some of these are things you shouldn't be and some of these are things you should be, right? So I had to change the words over in the right so when you score them, you know, good things show up in the far right. Y'all see what I'm getting at? So some things you should never do, some things you should always do. So you can deal with that. Maybe we can talk through it. So I want you to put these down. I'm wondering whether I should tell you the rest of the assignment or not before we get through. Okay, let's just do it. Are you known for holiness, that is separation from worldly thoughts and things? Are you known for that? Is that your reputation? Obvious to others. Are you boastful of questionable past activities? I could say more about that. There are many things in our lives we are ashamed of. We should be proud of the fact that we've overcome them. But that's not the same as being proud of the fact that we did them one time. You see what I'm saying? I think sometimes we are too proud of things we've done when we lost our temper or we abused somebody or took advantage. Oh, we repented, sure enough, but that was demonstrating what kind of a man I was. Are you prayer initiator and leader? 1 Timothy 2. Do you lose your temper, make threats, or act rashly, any of those, to defend your rights, to defend your respect, or to defend your manhood, whatever you think that means, whatever that means to you? By the way, unfortunately, this would have to do with behavior at home as well. I think sometimes we're way better in public than we are in the home environment. I'm ashamed to say that. Y'all know what I mean by that. It's just too comfortable. We figure, hey, they know who I am, so I kind of loosen up, and then I show them who I really am. But that would include with kids, for example. Number 5, do you tolerate insults without anger or desire for revenge and instead respond in kindness? Number 6, do you struggle emotionally when you lose in competition or maybe your team loses, I don't know, or you're overly exuberant when you win? As if winning and losing was a key thing, as if it gave me value and represented something that I should be rejoicing about. Do you have habits that displace important activities which you cannot control yourself to do without? Y'all know what I'm talking about? They don't mean they're bad necessarily, but bad ones would be included. But I mean a habit. I mean, if it was in the high school class, I talked about video games or something that's fairly addictive and it gets in the way of studies or other good things. So do you have something like that? Could be TV, could be a hobby. But it's a matter of self-control. Temperance, I think, was one of the characteristics for elders. Number 8, do you keep commitments, meet deadlines, follow instructions from those in authority without resentment? I don't resent that, even if it's not the best idea, maybe, but I do it. Are you deceptive or conniving to gain advantage, get your way, build a reputation, or ensure a win? And that could mean just to get a good deal on a car I'm trying to buy or something like that. Use deception for that or some kind of trickery. You take care to ensure that nothing you do can be misconstrued as sinful or motivated by evil. Take thought for things that are honorable in the sight of all men. You use insults or profanity or become withdrawn and sullen. Either one, they're both punishment, to show your displeasure for something or to get your way. Is that how we respond to someone who has done something against us or harmed us or inconvenienced us or insulted? Do you discount fears and emotions in others, particularly maybe kids or wives, as if they were weaknesses? I skipped 11. No, I didn't. 13. Are others ever reluctant to approach you because of how you might react, including kids? Are you easily provoked to anger toward someone or criticism of that person, that didn't read too well, who caused you inconvenience? 15, are you tolerant of ignorance, clumsiness, immaturity, illogic, or incompetence in others? Are you eager to forgive others who have wronged you? Eager to forgive. Eager to forgive so they will not feel that you hold a grudge against them. Okay, so here's the rest of the assignment. I think I would like you, if you have, you're married or have someone who would know you pretty well, I wish you would take this and let them fill it out as well and see if there's the kind of a similar assessment to what you put down, and take it to heart one way or another. Well, that's a good point. They're up here. Yes. Yeah. 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 That's a good question. I think it's a snapshot now. Where do you think you are? And I hope that whomever you ask will say that. That's where you are now, maybe. That's part of that. So here's the other thing, the main thing, really, whether you do that or not. It's a way, just to let the wives know we're doing something down here, I guess. But by the way, it's another thing we need to do as soon as we get done with this. If you got a zero on, one of the columns over there, that's, I think, you're a loser. I think it's a problem. I think that there may be, if you're struggling with that, you should think about repenting and maybe doing some things that change the precursor behaviors that lead to that, or the circumstances, all the things that reflect repentance, right, that could begin to change that. Get help, get some kind of accountability or advice or something. Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. 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 I don't like the term balance. That's a pet peeve, but I know what you're saying. I'm picturing Jesus in the synagogue, Mark 3. And there's a man with a withered hand, and he looks around, and there are all these people. And you can get yourself worked up about this. And they forget where this man is. And the whole deal in their mind is, can we get him to do something miraculous on the Sabbath so we can have... And he's just angry. It says he looked on him with anger, right? And yet his if you think about what motivated it, where was his head when he was thinking about that? What about the self-control? What did he say? For whose benefit did he say it? What was the follow-up action? You know what I mean? I hope these don't come across as saying we need to be passive, not courageous people. These are more about being selfish and out of control and giving in to the desires of the flesh, in my opinion. Maybe I've not worded them very well, but that's what I intended to do with this. Yeah, I got it. And right. Right. Yeah. So if you're wrestling with, how do I deal with my male character in a fallen world with God's commands overlaid, which I know are for my good and for my wife's good and my family's good and the church's good to live this way, how does that express itself? And what are the guidelines for dealing with that? At the same time, there are strengths that we have as men. We haven't gotten to these yet. God made soldiers. He sent these guys into battle, and he said, if you're afraid, you're not qualified. You're out. So how do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile that? I wonder, are we in a war of any kind? I'm getting ahead of myself. But you see the point. Is there a place for courage and conviction and doing hard things that are maybe risky and all that? So y'all are getting Maybe you're as confused as I am. If that's true, maybe that's where we were headed. Okay, so I hope that's helpful to you. I want to mention this, I don't know. Are y'all tough enough to go to like 9? Yeah. Okay, so I just want to talk about this. We'll come back to a minute. It seems to me that if we put the qualifications of leaders or men generally in a category, I think you could apply this to being fathers or husbands, that they kind of fall in three categories. And I think you can look at these qualifications. If we look at husbands and fathers, we can kind of put them in these buckets. It's probably artificial. They're all dependent on each other. But I can think of them as the three S's. The first is spirituality. That's something that is really, it's inside. Now, of course, it expresses itself probably in the next two, but the point is, I have a deep faith. Whatever I'm good at, whatever I look like on the outside, I believe in God. I think I've put some things in the lesson there. You can read what those mean. Do you really believe in God? Do you believe in the inspiration of Scripture and the wisdom of that? Are you committed to be holy inside? Do you do some deeds and alms that are not seen by men? You could think about that, Matthew 6, as an example. You see what I'm asking there? It's an inside thing. And I know what you're going to say. You'd say, well, if you have that, you'll express it. So, oh, yes, that's true. I'm just trying to put them in categories here. So it's a self-discipline. It's the foundation for the other two. It's seen mostly by God. It's really the pure motivation for the other two. And I'll come back to that in just a minute. There's this a second area that of the qualifications seem to fall in the category of denying self. I really am committed to the benefit of others. I love my wife as myself. No man ever hated his own flesh. That kind of thing. Where I'm committed really to the benefit of others. And I think if I have to think about temper or hard things and courageous things, one question that probably ought to be asked is this just for my benefit or my pride, or does it have a larger purpose that helps other people? That sets the right example. That helps to change a person's life who needs desperately to change for the sake of their soul. You see, that's a good question to ask. But is our activity, our attention, our motivation, is it really aimed at helping others in a sacrificial way? By the way, I'll stop there and say, have you ever heard of anybody saying, what are the two greatest commandments? What are they? What's the first? And what's the second? It looks outward, right? And guess what? Almost all the law and commandments relate to those two, right? Come from those two. And then I think we're ready to talk about what we kind of sometimes first talk about, which is, but are you skillful? Right? Are you pretty good? Do you know a whole bunch of Bible verses? Right? Do you know how to manipulate your wife so she's happy most of the time? Right? And if you were coming for hints on that, you might be disappointed. You see what I'm getting? But that's kind of, we often start there. Did Jesus talk about people who were pretty good at giving alms and making great prayers and things like that, but they might have been missing the other two? On the other hand, do you want to leave the bottom one out? I mean, I said before, those are expressions of the other two. If I'm deeply committed to holiness and service to God and service to others, what am I going to do but learn more of the Bible and become skillful at waiting on tables if I'm a deacon? If that's my job, I'm going to learn how to do it. Why? Because I'll look good? No, because I'm serving others. That's my motive. Does this make sense? I think sometimes we skip to the third one and we want to know what are the tricks that are going to keep my wife from complaining or make my kids turn out to be good students, right, and not get into trouble. I need to know all those hints of when to spank them and when not. Good questions, hard questions. We need to learn. We can learn from the experience of others. But do you see these other things come first? They have to grow out of that. And we'll see that as we look at the qualifications as we go through. But just think about these as a way to look at those. Okay, so am I only to? Oh, I'm on to module three. Yeah. So let's take 5 minutes, stretch a little bit, and I'm not going to cover. Oh, sorry. One other assignment. Turn to page. I think it's at the 8 or 9. Yeah, it's page 8. And you see where it says building romance? See that one? I would like to take your hand and put it over that. Cover it over. Okay. All right, great. That's great. So when you go home, tell your wives we covered romance tonight. All right? Because I don't think we're going to have time to get to it. All right? 5 minute break. That's good. Role of men in family relationships. First thing I want to ask is, what is the purpose of marriage? What is the purpose? What's the goal of a marriage? This chart says, I'm going to tell you what it isn't, but so don't answer that. What are some things it's not? Yeah, I'll get to that. Thank you. That's right. But this is kind of that idea. Do you know that in most people's thinking, marriage is kind of the culmination of romance? In other words, you fall in love. And of course, in our society, everything's backward and upside down, and I don't even know what it means anymore. But in theory, at least, the idea was you'd fall in love with someone. And marriage was the culmination of that romance. It's the thing that allowed then that romance to be permanent and flourish forever, to live happily ever after, right? And that was kind of the idea. You might fall in love with someone, but it might not happen. But that would be the purpose of a marriage. I don't think that's it. I think romance can flourish, and it maybe only flourishes in the best way within the marriage situation, but I don't think it's the purpose. I don't think that's the Bible teaching on it. It's really not personal fulfillment or security. It's not to give a sense of accomplishment, some type of psychological or social security. It may do that, right? Two are better than one, and you can, one's sick, the other one can help the other. Right? That's all true. That's the case. It's an advantage, a benefit. I don't think it's the purpose, though. For a Christian, for sure. Personal pleasure and convenience. If you think about any of these purposes, what if if that's the purpose of marriage and it fails to be true anymore, like it's not fun anymore, it's not convenient anymore, then what do you do with the marriage? I mean, if the goal, the overarching purpose of the thing is not satisfied, then where are you? I don't think the overarching goal of marriage is personal affluence or financial security. I don't think, although are there people who get married because they need to have that security or they need to be legal immigrants or whatever the purpose would be. It's not for social expediency, to be accepted. It used to be if you got pregnant, that's probably what you should do from the standpoint of reputation. That's not thought about much anymore, but that would be not the right reason. To ensure success, to have children, for example, maybe one of that, to live out my ambitions. What is the purpose, the goal of marriage for Christians? What is the purpose? It certainly does that. And maybe the purpose God had in instituting marriage was to help understand that mystery, as he talks about in Ephesians 5, right? Or maybe it's the other way around, I'm not sure, but still, yeah. I hope another one doesn't pop up, because I think I'm going to go to the next chart. So I was thinking that it's not to improve the condition of the human race. We often talk about, marriages and homes fail, then the whole society is going to, that probably is true too, but still. Here are some suggestive passages. A woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. Why? Why would you go through that? An unbeliever. It doesn't even say he's a nice guy. But if he's willing to stay with you, why would you do that? It might actually help save his soul. And what if he's a Christian who's made a bad mistake? A brother in Christ? Would this not apply even maybe more so? The hope would even be higher that he would understand and repent. So she should stay in the marriage. Why? Because it's fun? Because they have kids, because they can get along better economically, because you'll have a bad reputation if you're a divorcee? Is that the reason? Or is it for something more important than that? Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. This is 1 Peter 3. You know the context, right? What's the context of 1 Peter 3? Wives who are married to non-Christians. And I wondered, are they idolaters? Do they go to the temple and engage in that worship? They're not Christians. Why would they not? And yet, he's saying, what? Live in a specific way. He talks more about that later. They're adorning. Be submissive that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won. What does he mean, won? He'll grow to love you finally. Is that what he means by that? No, I think he means they're saved. They come to obey the word without preaching from their wife. I think that's what that means. And fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. Bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. He's not actually just saying make them be good kids so they'll have good careers and they'll be self-disciplined and won't get arrested later. It's something to do with the admonition of the Lord. Do not hold back discipline. Though you strike him with a rod, he will not die. Interesting contrast in these two. You shall strike him with a rod, and not only will he not die, but what? You save him from death. It's kind of an interesting play on words there. Save his soul from Sheol. So if you look at these passages, John says the thing that makes him rejoice the most, probably figuratively children, is that they walk in the truth. Not that they have great jobs, not that they themselves have great marriages and lots of grandkids, but that they walk in the truth. What is the purpose for a Christian family? Is it that simple? And what is our endeavor? What is our purpose in life that we ought to be helping each other, leading on the one hand or helping on the other? Am I overselling that point? Does that put a different spin on what the leadership should all be about? We kind of think of it as I'm the decision maker, or we have a tie, make the tie-breaking vote on money or something. Where are we leading to? What's the journey? What's the battle, if we want to talk about that, right? What's the danger? I think it starts with this. And now it kind of makes more sense that when God looked at rulers, men, and he gave qualifications, what was kind of the first thing? Was it their kind of everyday competence, or was it something to do with their faith in him, their dedication, their holiness, and that kind of thing? You see what I'm trying to say? I think we should think of it. So there's a couple of ways to look at marriage, and I'll use this as a way to illustrate it. It takes longer to explain than probably it's worth. But here's a way to think about the way your worldview. How do you organize your life? How do you make decisions? What's important and what's not? And one way to think of it, there's a basic reason that you live, right? There are some who live, of whom I tell you weeping, that their God is their belly and their glory is their shame. We wouldn't know any people like that. But their basic reason for living is what? Pleasure. If I'm not happy, then I'm changing something. If I'm not fulfilled, and by whatever I mean by that, I'm changing it. And you know what? Sex in particular is one of the most pleasurable, deepest kind of experiences you can have, right? Everybody understands that. And so that would make me happy to have that available. And what is one way to make sure you have a sexual partner available, willing? What's one way? You can get married. People would never get married just because they're like sexually attracted to somebody and ignore a bunch of other things. That would never happen, would it? Right? But, you know, there are other ways to have that pleasure, aren't there, that don't involve marriage. In fact, in some ways, they may create some excitement that exceeds what you might get by one kind of twisted view of things. But if my God is my belly, if my goal in life is pleasure, then I'll decide. And so here's a way to read this pyramid chart. The how goes up. If I ask you the question, how are you going to get sexual pleasure? How? You read up. What's on the top block? Well, I get married, or I find another partner, or do something, right? And the why reads down. So why do I get married in this picture? Read down, right? I want that. Why do I want that pleasure? Because my life's goal. That's what I'm doing. That's what my life is about. You see that. The other thing about this, and you can see it in the way people make decisions, is the upper blocks are less important. They get removed if they don't satisfy or fulfill the why of the blocks below. You see that? So if my wife doesn't fulfill the purpose that she's the how, right, for the, and if she's sick or not cooperative or, you know, fails in some other way for whatever reason, that block gets replaced with another block that satisfies that, because the more foundational blocks are the permanent ones. They're the ones that provide meaning and purpose. They're the why. They're the why for what we decide to do. Can you see that? Does this reflect the world as you see it today in any way? And you will talk to people who will say, this is healthy for my kids, for me to get out of this marriage, because I don't want them to see me, fill in the blank, unhappy. right? They need to understand that that's not, I don't want them to live in a way that would make them, after all, what are we here for if it isn't to be satisfied and to be happy and all that? And that informs our thinking about that. And romance is just some wonderful thing. It's like a god, and if these things in the upper blocks don't give us that, then we just replace them some way. Do you see that? So is there another, maybe another way of looking at this? If you have that, decisions are motivated by pleasure. Relationships are judged successful if they provide that. Marriage is as temporary as the emotions that led us to do it in the first place, right? So let's look at another one. We make it our aim, 2 Corinthians 5, to be well-pleasing to Him, right? For we must all stand before the judgment seat of God. If that's the bottom block, should it be? Shouldn't it be? Everything we do is ordered around that. Would there be a reason to marry? I'm asked the why question. Why do you get married? How do you read the why? Read down. What's the purpose? What's the why? What's the why for, why do I get married? Somehow it's going to help me do that, right? And if it's a decision that I come to and it's not going to help me in my pleasing to God, I don't do it. I just don't do it. I don't decide that. Why do I have romance? Well, I think it strengthens the marriage. And that suggests that we're somehow in control of the romance. We can develop it. We can make it happen. We can encourage it, right? But I think it's an upper block. Because if you flip it around and say, no, romance is the why, marriage is the how, what happens when the romance fails? Which, by the way, it's a pretty ephemeral kind of a thing through your life, right? I mean, you can kind of like miss a meal and there's trouble, you know? It's just not a very stable basis for something, right? So this commitment is the bottom line, and then above that's the romance. And then I think sex has its place in this very safe and stable environment that's secure. But what's the why of sexual pleasure? Well, romance. What's the why of that? It strengthens the marriage. What's the why of that? Because it's part of my whole scheme in my life to find ways to please God. Now, it's not always perfect. But I still think that bottom block would inform what we want to do. I think it actually breaks out into saving ourselves and saving others. And so the marriage ought to inform both of those things as the how. The why is I'm going to save myself and save somebody else. And that's the purpose of that. So you see, that's a little bit better, a lot better. Values are determined by stable standard, not by... You see, what pleases me is going to change throughout the course of my life. You understand that? It's not a very stable basis. It will change over time. Okay, I want to talk about the two become one flesh. I think we already... No, we didn't. We talked about this. So when I go to the Genesis account, it says the two will become one flesh. Whatever that means in a marriage relationship, I think we learn about that maybe from the way Jesus used that. I think that stands as one of the mysteries that may be revealed as time goes on, mostly by Christ in the church, but how it's used. Where are the three places where that's quoted in the New Testament? You probably know one. We've already talked about Ephesians 5, right? What are the other two? Matthew 19. What's the point of Matthew 19? It's about divorce. In fact, he says what God has joined together, one flesh, what? Don't tear it apart. If something is one thing, you're not supposed to divide it, tear it apart. And the third place that this is quoted, does anybody know where the third place is? Good, yeah, 1 Corinthians 6. And what's the teaching there about? What's the content? Yeah, that's right. It's dealing with a specific sin of fornication, right? And he says you're joined to a harlot, you're joining the body of Christ to the harlot. Why is that? Well, because you're one flesh. It's kind of this idea. So I think we can learn maybe what the one flesh passage means in Genesis by looking at how it's used. For one thing, it means there's this sense of my body includes my spouse, my wife's body, and I'm never going to do anything harmful to her. I think that's the teaching in Ephesians 5. Because it's really, we're one flesh. It's like my arm or my leg, and I'm going to, not only am I not going to harm it, I'm going to actually help it grow. I'm going to make it comfortable. I might even, like, tickle it if it feels good. You know, be on the positive side. Because it's me. It's me. That's the point. It's one flesh, right? Second point is, from Matthew 19, I think, that they're one flesh, and you just can't tear it apart. Would you tear your arm off? Would you do that? Of course you would. It's one flesh. Now, you could. It would be bloody. You would be covered with violence, to use the passage, maybe Matthew, in Malachi. But you shouldn't do it. It's like one body. You can't tear it apart. You shouldn't do that. And then finally, the one in 1 Corinthians, I think there's maybe more to it than to say, don't interrupt it or don't corrupt it with a sexual sin. Because he goes on to say that really, this is this oneness with Christ that you're interfering with. You're bringing the attitude, the consent, the temptation, the evil action of a harlot into this fellowship with Christ. Isn't that kind of what he's saying? Maybe I'm stretching a little bit there. I think he's saying that there is this fellowship with Christ, one spirit that you have. You're like one flesh. I think a husband and wife should grow to where they have that one spirit, right? And it maybe it's an emotional bond, but it's also probably one purpose and one mind and that agreement. And when someone else interferes into that, you've broken into that one flesh. I think that's the idea. Just read, he says, do you not know that bodies are members of Christ? Do you not know that he is joined with the harlot, one body with the two or one flesh, but he is joined with the Lord, it's one spirit with him. There's something more than just some kind of physical union. So I think we learn about one flesh to say, certainly it's permanent. It's a selflessness that's a reflection of that, but it's also an agreement in spirit that's reflected there. Whatever that mystery is, we understand it more from watching Christ and the church, I think. Okay, so let's go back to our diagram. We looked at before. I'm going to skip ahead of that because I want to. Yeah, okay. So this is from Ephesians 5, and I think I have some questions in there that you can fill in. What are some of the roles that we learn the husband has from looking at what Christ did for the church? I think this is, you probably know these. What are some things that he did? What are some of the action verbs you find there in Ephesians 5? You should probably look at it. Okay, it's getting late. I just want to get to the last diagram, and that'll be it for tonight. But you got to help me. It'll go faster if you just answer. What are some of the action verbs you find in here in Ephesians 5? Sorry, what? Yeah, right. How does that look in our lives? If he's the head, you read Colossians and he says, from the head, we're joined to Christ, the head, from whom we're nourished and you're caused to grow is kind of the idea. What does that look like in a husband-wife relationship? How do we actually cause her to grow if that's what the role of the head is, for her benefit? Are there ways we can help our wives grow in some way? Yeah, yeah. Can you be specific example? Remember, we're trying to help each other be better servants in the kingdom. I'm just looking for specific. I was just thinking about this this week and thinking there must be some specific examples I can. Pardon? Okay, you're increasing their knowledge. Have y'all ever had a situation where your wife could be serving, but she's not as secure in doing that? Or doesn't maybe have the opportunity, the skills, or the reinforcement, or the encouragement, or whatever, and you could kind of help her do it. I think that's what Christ is doing as the head, you know, and that is he's providing this growth that kind of comes from there, based on Colossians. Right. Yeah. Yes. So you're going to be affirming. You're going to make sure that there's not any sense of failure if something didn't go exactly right. But I think there's a place, maybe this is the leadership expressed, where you say to your wife, you could be good at this. You haven't tried it, but we can work on it together. Does your wife teach classes? Is she nervous about that? Are there occasions where she could maybe reach out to younger women? I don't know if everybody's married here or not, but just think about that. You know, that's intimidating to a lot of women. I think being an elder's wife is intimidating sometimes. But these are areas of growth that require some level of encouragement. Yeah, Brent. Mm-hmm. So I'll just confess it. This is the thought I had underneath this, and I'm trying to sneak up on it, but it's too late in the night for that. But I think we think about headship, and the first thing that comes to our mind is who gets to make decisions. And we think leadership, that's who gets to call the shots. And the more I'm thinking about this, I'm having less and less confidence that that's really even part of this picture, really. Christ gives us commands. There's no doubt about that. But to some extent, in our life, it's a voluntary, and there's a lot of things left to our judgment and our conviction to do. But I don't know. I'm struggling with this, just like the other thing, too. But I'd like for us to move a little bit away from who gets to call the shots, who's in charge, who gets to, handle all the money, and rather think about what are we doing as the head? What is the benefit that we get to give our wives? Not so much about decision making. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yep. Right. I got the kids. Go to the ladies' class. If you've never taught one before, I know you're nervous. Hey, I'll go over it with you if you want. Right? Hey, I heard you did really well. Do y'all see what I'm saying? I don't know. I had this experience, right? So, and it was, in the end, looking back, it was one of the things I did okay at, I think. And that was to say, I know you haven't ever done this before, but you can. Don't be so nervous about it. It's going to be okay. Didn't help at all. But I think there was growth. I could see that growth. Some things are precious to me. Some recordings and things like that where, so I have habits that I grow. I initiate. I encourage development. Try new things. Mentor somebody for the first time. Older women teach the younger women. How many times does that happen? Do we have a role in helping them do that? I think so. I think that's what Christ does for us. Saves. I'm going to protect her from negative consequences. And if she has made mistakes, I'm not going to let those. Is that what Christ did for us? In our mistakes, he kept us from suffering the consequences? Or do we take the attitude, hey, you made the mistake, you figure out how to fix it. Right? And I'm not taking all the burden for what you've done wrong. Christ loved us. I wonder if we are making wives the center of our thought as if that we had no other job. We're tending to be obsessed with the thorns and the sweat of our face and all that kind of thing. But I wonder if that attention, the same way that Christ had the church as his center of attention, maybe that's what that means, in loving as Christ did. These are just maybe simple examples or thoughts. I'll do without. Do we do without anything? Like supper? Or, our hobbies or our toys or our guys out night or whatever. Do we ever do without and and give up time and things just for her benefit and pleasure? Sanctifies and cleanses. Now Christ did that for the church, and that's because we were perfect. We never make mistakes, and we had never been a problem. I think we quickly forgive. Forget, that means don't keep account of evil. It means don't bring it up. See the good, expect the best, even when it's probably not a rational thing to do, but hope she lives up to it and praise the things that are good. Presents glorious, I think that's not criticizing for sure, but it's also offering praise in public and in private. More than is deserved. Is that the way we are as Christians in Christ's work for us? I don't allow any harm. I don't create the harm. I don't allow it. And if there is pain, I'm going to be part of that because it's my body. And whatever created that pain, I'm going to suffer as well. But I'm going to try to mitigate it. I'm going to try to take it away just like I would if it was my little finger or my arm or my leg hurting. I detect emotional and physical needs, and I fill them. If she's hungry somehow for something, I need to provide that nourishment. And whatever it is, if it's security, if it's understanding what the plan is, if there's some consequence that she's afraid of, I better figure that out and decide how to fill that need, that insecurity, whatever it is. It may just be a need for closeness. It may be a need to talk over and over things again, or to feel valued. And just because she's not a man, and I don't think I would ever have that need, that has nothing to do with it. This is what it means to fulfill the needs and nourish and cause to grow. cherishes, cares for. I think that means I'm going to assist, I'm going to pamper, I'm going to please, and I'm motivated by the affection, and it's fun to do. This is not a burden. Now, you understand some of these sound like mechanical things. Remember what we said? Spirituality, selflessness, and then let's work on the mechanics. So they ought to, but still, I think this is what we learn from Christ and the church. Oh, we're united in action and purpose from verse 30. I think you have to have constant communication to know what's going on, what you're thinking, what she's thinking, and make those more and more unison. And then I create pleasure and satisfaction. And just like the pain is shared sympathetically, one body, all the pleasure is shared sympathetically. And that's the purpose, is her pleasure, but it's shared. That's the wonderful thing. We're one flesh. And so those are shared together. I think I see that and probably a whole lot more in that passage. But Ephesians 5, of course, the giant passage about husbands and wives. The mystery is great. I speak of Christ in the church, but I think they both teach us about each other. Okay, come on. So let's go back to this picture. I don't know that we know for sure what ruling over means. I think it's a bad thing. I think it's a male inclination that's probably not healthy. It's a result of the fall. It's some corruption in the world that we need to worry about. And I think whatever the desire of the woman is for the man is, it's an insecurity or something that the world would be better off maybe without that somehow. I don't know for sure what it is. Maybe it's this desire to draw him into her life, to be secure. Maybe it's the desire to control him, to rule over him, and he's got to fight back by ruling in a fallen world. I don't know. But what did we just learn? What are the husbands told to do in Ephesians 5? Love. That's kind of the main thing, isn't it? Husbands, love your wives. And what are the wives told to do in that passage? By the way, it doesn't say husbands force your wives to submit. But what are the wives told to do? Does that have any place in this picture at all? I mean, for example, if the woman submits willingly, honorably, cheerfully, respectfully, calling him Lord, is it 1 Peter 3? What will happen to that desire of the husband to try to be in control of her? It almost is like a moot point. That's not an issue. I already have the respect. I have that cooperation. I'm in control in a strange way that's wonderful, you know, that I don't have to do that. And what happens if the husband loves the wife and her insecurity or her desire or her need to, you know, own him and control him? What happens if he's already loving her in a selfish way? I think so. That love just satisfies it. To whatever extent we can do that as in a fallen world with all the influences there. Do you see that in Christ we're trying to get back to the garden picture where things were more or less ideal, and these consequences, whatever they mean, and I don't know for sure, that are negative, I think the plan that Christ demonstrated in Christ and the church is actually taking away those effects of the fall. There may be ways in which those others are actually taken away as well, but we won't talk about that. But I think that's the picture. The man's natural tendency is fulfilled. The woman's natural emotional tendency is fulfilled by love from her husband. And so we're kind of getting a little bit closer to the garden family, aren't we? This fellowship with God and then this unity with each other. I think that's maybe the picture. That's probably not a bad place to start. I'll just skip through this. I'm going to take a couple more minutes. Y'all ever have new CEOs or new directors or new general managers come into your company in some way? We just had a new director hired in last summer. The way we do it at university is it's all open. There's huge committees and there's, you know, group interviews and everything. But you probably heard questions like this. What is your vision for this organization? You ever heard that? And what do you think our core competencies are? And what are our weaknesses? And what would be your plan to overcome those weaknesses to meet the goals? And what are your goals for this organization? Are those fair questions? Right? Have you all ever been asked those kind of questions before in an interview? Maybe if you're in a leadership role of some kind? Are they reasonable questions? Where are we good? Where are we weak? What are you going to do to fix it? Where are you going to take us? You know, what's your plan? So you're head of a family. Are you ready to be interviewed to be head of that family? Where are you going to take them? What are our weaknesses as a family? What are our strengths that we can build on? What are our core competencies, if you want to use kind of more secular? And what are you going to do? What's our plan? What kind of initiation are you going to take? Are you ready to be interviewed to be the head of your house? Are you ready for that interview? My question. So, I think there has to be a realistic assessment. So stop and think, you know. And I'll just say this. If there's an immediate problem right now, who's responsible to fix that? Even if it's something your wife has done and it's causing you to be a part, who is the initiator of the solving of problems? Who is it? Did Christ do that for the church? Did he take the initiative? Did he make a plan before the world was even made that he was going to kind of come and fix that? I'll tell you what, if you're standing back and waiting for your wife to straighten up, that's not being the leader. That doesn't mean you're going to go let her have it till she changes. You're going to show love. You're going to draw her with that same kind of sacrificial action that Jesus did, right? But still, if there's an immediate problem, that's burning right now. That needs to be addressed. Maybe tonight. There's some specific issue that's between you. Because it's festering. It's causing damage day by day. And that's true. Anything you lead. Something's bleeding. We're losing money here. Sell the... you take action when something's wrong as a leader. What can you build on? What are weaknesses that we need to protect against? If we can't fix those weaknesses, let's find a way to build a wall around them so they don't become a source of temptation or problem for us. Are there trends that you can see? We're getting worse at this. We're okay, but we're not as good as we were a year ago, or we're better. What's discouraging or disturbing? If you're not making a realistic assessment of where your relationship with your wife is going as a family, what are we good at? What can we accomplish, especially in the kingdom? I'm not sure what you're doing in leadership, right? If it's just about whether to buy the new car or not, or to choose a Chevrolet or a Ford, and I get the deciding vote, we're missing the point. That's not what the leadership is about. But sometimes we get that in our mind, right? I don't know why. I think because we're so concerned about getting our rights or who gets to have their way or something. We may say more about that. So then, let's think, by the way, this new leader, I'm about to hire him. What is your vision of this organization in 10 years from now or something? You know, that's, what is it really? Where will we be? Where will we be in our ability to host guests in our home or to contribute to the church or in our skills in teaching or co-teaching together or whatever it is, you know? And then what initiatives can we take in the near term? And our example, our specific guidance, we stand, I think, as we were talking about this at the break, leaders need to be respected, right? And there's one way to do that is to make people respect us. You stand up when I'm talking to you, right? And so I'm going to modify your behavior where it looks like respect. Is that the way to get respect? Or do you show in the genuine character, no, I really am concerned about you. And I do things that you don't even know about. You may find out later that it's not a matter of show. It's not a matter of forcing behavior. I'm respected because I'm doing things. So I'm a standard for my entertainment, my language, my behavior, my associations, how I use my time, the integrity and honesty with which I speak. That's what a leader is, isn't it? Is that you're the best at that. You get up before the troops and you go to bed after they... Yeah, this is what he was telling me. So and this is how you get the respect in the military. Oh, you can yell at people and frighten them and stuff, and that might change their behavior, but that's not respect, is it? And that won't build that leadership. So that's what we're doing. Daily, weekly, monthly practices, for example, worship attendance, among easy examples. Expressions of both affection and direction of habits that we'd like to start. Okay, I'm trying to find this. So that's the end. So here's more forms to fill out, right? I think you'll find these on page number 8, okay? And I'm going to come back in the morning, and I know we put our hands over that one section, but we may talk about that a little more in the morning. But look at this self-assessment, and this is more specifically habits and things that, once again, this is something maybe you'd rather your wife read this one. And maybe don't fill it in, let her check it off. Maybe that's the thing to do. But I've grouped them in the area of spirituality. You only will know this first part. What is your core? This is Covey-ish, if you know Stephen Covey. You know, you got to start with what you are inside. What are your real values? As a Christian, we know what it is. You need to answer these questions because they have to do with what are... And then, How selfish am I or not is the second area, sacrifice and service, top of page 9. And then once those are in place, I think then you think about, am I getting better at the skills and the strength to do this, right? And the mechanics in a way, but it's the thing that comes with time and with work and so on. But it's motivated by the other two. All right, that's all. That's enough for tonight. You guys have stayed long enough already. How do you want to conclude?